This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, and it's been a heck of a day here in New York City and for many across the country after reports of pipe bombs sent to President Barack Obama, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, and to the offices of CNN. Speaking at a press conference in Manhattan, New York City, Mayor Bill de Blasio condemned any and all calls for violence.
Let's just say this to all public officials of all partisan affiliations. Don't encourage violence. Don't encourage hatred. Don't encourage attacks on media. You could disagree, but you have to show respect for people and air your disagreements peacefully. So unfortunately, this atmosphere of hatred is contributing to the choices people are making to turn to violence. There's no question about it. And the way to stop that is to turn back the other way, to bring down the temperature, to end any messages about the use of violence against people we disagree with. And that has to start at the top.
We'll be following this story, and tomorrow on the show, we'll be talking about the rise of hatred among different political factions. And we want to hear from you. No matter where you fall on the political spectrum, how do you feel about people on, quote unquote, the other side? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE and tell us whether you think our divided politics is increasing our contempt for our fellow Americans. And if so, how are you seeing that play out in your own life? But we start today's show with a look at campaign ads and how political rhetoric has been heating up.
You may not see it yet, but it's out there. Danger, lurking in the race for Congress.
After 20 years in Washington, Congressman Steve Chabot stopped helping us and started helping himself.
Republicans know that it's dangerous to change the presumption of innocence to a presumption of guilt, especially for black men.
Would he take protections away for people with pre-existing conditions? Yes.
Scott Wallace has radical values and funds radical causes.
Congressman Mike Kaufman fled a town hall to avoid questions.
But Lizzie Fletcher would weaken and divide us.
Barbara Comstock, 97.8% with Donald Trump.
Gridlock. And then impeachment. Is that really what you want? Voting for any Democrat gets you all of that.
Yes, it must be October when you hear those deep bass synth notes and the scary warnings. But this year, it's on another level, especially when it comes to money. Here to discuss are Erica Franklin Fowler, Associate Professor of Government at Wesleyan University, where she directs the Wesleyan Media Project. Hi, Erica.
Hi.
And Steve Passwader, Vice President and General Manager of Kantar Media's Campaign Media Analysis Group. Hi, Steve.
Hello there.
All right, guys, let's talk. Erica, we're in the final push here, a couple days right before the midterm elections. We heard some ads just now. In terms of messaging, what themes are you seeing emerge during these campaign ads for Democrats and for Republicans?
Well, the 2018 midterms are all about healthcare. We're hearing about healthcare from candidates on both sides of the aisle, though Democrats are certainly talking about it more.
And what are some of the, I mean, we talked a little bit about what the creative look and feel of these ads are, Erica, but like every time I see an ad, I feel like they all look and sound the same. It's either the menacing candidate or the family guy, right? There feels like there's little in between in terms of creativity. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, you have your classic biographical spots, which are the positive ones where candidates are walking through a park with their family and invariably a dog. And then you have the attack ads, which are going to go after the opponent, usually in a policy-based way, although we're certainly seeing some more personal attacks as well.
And Steve, let's talk about the money here. I mean, are we seeing an increase in spending this year from the 2014 midterm elections?
Without question. We're in the process of shattering every spending level that was achieved in 2014, and that's across the board. No question about it. The PACs are clearly leading the charge this time around, and whether it's a Senate Majority Fund or Congressional Leadership Fund or the DCCC or its Republican counterpart, the RNCC, there is just an enormous amount of spending going on all over the country and in all levels of races. It is really extraordinary to see how much money is being put forth in this cycle.
And do we have an estimate of how much money has been spent generally this year so far?
From our Kantar Media CMAG perspective, we're estimating broadcast television, good old linear TV, will do, on the broadcast side, probably somewhere around $2.7 billion this year. Local cable looks very well positioned to top the billion-dollar mark. And digital, which is an intriguing part of the political spend, just because it's on such a tremendous growth trajectory, is going to approach around $1 billion this year. And these levels are well in excess of where we finished 2014.
And I'm wondering also about the ability to, well, the different types of ads that we're seeing. And Eric, I want to play you an ad from the Super PAC Future 45.
The screaming, the violence, the smears, and death threats. The far left moving to socialism, undefended open borders, immediate tax increases, 100% government-run health care. The booming economy stopped. Nancy Pelosi back in power, gridlock, and then impeachment. Is that really what you want? Voting for any Democrat gets you all of that. Future 45 is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Erica, I think that's one of the first times I've ever heard an ad that just unilaterally talks about a party versus a candidate. How new is that?
You know, I don't think it's that new, although certainly, I think, so here are the things that I think are consistent. The discussion and references to Nancy Pelosi make a perfect sense in this cycle. They don't have an incumbent president to use as the foil, so they're going to take the most, the highest leader that they can think of, and Nancy Pelosi is an obvious target because she's likely to become speaker should the Democrats retake the House. But certainly, I do think what you're feeling and what you're onto is certainly a rise of what I'm going to call identity politics, where the name of the game is really about talking down the other party as a way of lifting up your brand.
And this is an ad from a super PAC. Do you think, Erica, that people on the receiving end, the folks who are watching these ads or receiving these ads, understand that this isn't from a specific candidate, that this is from a super PAC? Does it matter?
It does matter, and here's why. I don't think that citizens necessarily pay all that much attention to the sponsors. However, we can tell you from a lot of experimental research that candidates who air negative ads will suffer some backlash. Citizens don't like negativity, and so they will punish a candidate who's seen as sponsoring an ad. If an outside group, and especially an outside group, Future 45 is a great example, that is not well known to a candidate sponsors an ad, not only do they protect the candidate from the backlash that would occur from the negativity should the candidate sponsor it, but also that ad tends to work better because there is no backlash and citizens tend to give a little more credibility to groups than they do to politicians who they don't tend to trust.
We also have an ad from the DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. They're targeting individual races to drive home their messaging about healthcare, as you mentioned, Erica, that's one of the big talking points, and also about Trump tax cuts. And I'm going to play you a clip from an ad that shows a group of executives sitting around a conference table. Take a listen.
Ever wonder where all that money went from the Republican tax bill?
What are you going to do with your tax cut?
I don't know, because I love Lamborghinis, but I already have a bunch, so.
You know that fancy bottled water, the Fiji water?
Yeah.
Going to fill my pool with those.
Maybe I could park one in my living room.
I am going to give my nanny a raise. Oh. Kidding. I'm going to get a bigger yacht. Do you like that one?
Erica, how effective is that ad?
So the effectiveness of any given ad is actually much harder to measure than you might think. But I do think that this particular ad is raising some themes that are likely to resonate among the American public, largely that the tax bill was unpopular and largely seen as benefiting the wealthy. So to the extent that the ad can play into those themes and remind citizens what the Republican tax bill, who it disproportionately benefits, I think can be a powerful message.
You know, another theme that the president has latched onto, and we're actually taking a look at this later in the show today, is immigration, the fear of immigration, the sort of stoking of fears of Muslim Americans or Muslim immigrants, the caravan that's coming up. How much has immigration played into any of these ads?
Immigration is not as prominent in advertising, as you might expect. In fact, that was one of the big surprises to me when we were most recently looking at the data, because you have a lot of polling suggesting that citizens are hearing a lot about immigration. And I think the place that they are hearing that is primarily in news media, because the focus on immigration in advertising is quite small. Republicans are certainly talking about it, and they were splitting time between it, certainly in the summer. But relative to healthcare and taxes, it's not as prominent an issue.
That's right. The only mentions of immigration that I've seen have been in Republican ads, and it's usually brought up in the form of open borders and sanctuary cities. Mm-hmm. That's how it's being positioned.
We've got about a minute left in the segment. I'm just curious from both of you. I know the effectiveness is difficult to measure, but do you think these ads are, effective or just annoying to a lot of folks?
Well, I think citizens will universally tell you that they dislike negative advertising. I think that's a constant throughout the modern campaign era. I do think if we want to talk about how it works, the issue is that you really want to break down, what do you mean by work? Does advertising persuade? Does it get people to tune in? Are they more likely to turn out? And you have different answers for those different questions. I do think part of the reason we see so much negativity is it is one way to sort of grab attention and get citizens to tune in and listen to the messaging.
Yeah, I agree with Erica there. I'm not sure how much it works, but my goodness, there is certainly an awful lot of it going on out there. And as we get closer and closer and closer, it gets more and more blunt in the message. I don't think, and Erica, I don't know how you feel about this, I've never seen the word liar come up so much in ads as what I've seen this year. The word he's lying, she's lying, they're lying, everybody's lying. It's incredibly popular. And, there used to be kind of a thing in politics where you didn't use the L word to describe your opponent. And clearly that's no longer operative. It's clearly a lot of negative ads that are out there are being refuted by people referring to their opponent as a liar.
And that will make citizens less likely to appreciate advertising, not that they really ever did. I think there's a fair amount of political science evidence to suggest that negative advertising can be beneficial from an informational perspective among the electorate. Right. But I do think the negative personal attacks are what they really don't like, because they see it as unfair. And I think that is going to, be a decisive thing that people will remember from this cycle.
Well, we'll see how it all turns out in just a couple weeks. Erica Franklin Fowler is Associate Professor of Government at Wesleyan University, where she directs the Wesleyan Media Project. And Steve Passwader is Vice President and General Manager of Kantar Media's Campaign Media Analysis Group, CMAG. Thanks to you both.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, your turn. Are you being slammed with political ads?
Hi, my name is Chris. I'm calling from Key West, Florida. Campaign ads are a way of life. I try to ignore the negative ads and look at the candidate. I just voted, and it's the first time ever I voted straight party line. The vitriolic left has created a divisive culture, and the result is party line politics.
This is Jeannie. I'm calling from Dallas, Texas. We must get money out of politics. It's a ridiculous way to encourage or discourage people about voting in a particular way. And no ordinary citizen can be expected to wade through all the propaganda being paid for by money from interested, quote-unquote, parties.
Hi, my name is Nancy, and I'm calling from South Florida. Yes, we absolutely are completely bombarded with nonstop campaign ads in South Florida. I never thought I'd miss regular commercials. It's the same political ads over and over and over again, primarily attack ads. First, you have one candidate, then the opposing candidate, both of them attacking each other. Every now and then, I see a candidate who's actually saying something positive about what they're planning to accomplish once elected, but those are few and far between.
This is Tom Lenhart from St. Peter, Minnesota. In Minnesota's first congressional district, we're seeing some pretty nasty outside political advertisements. One of the worst ads I've seen comes from the outside RNCC, which compares the Democratic challenger Dan Fian, a school teacher and two-time Iraq War veteran, to get this, a terrorist. The RNCC comparing war veterans running for office with terrorists pretty much sums up how deplorable political advertisements have become.
Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. And don't worry, in about 2 weeks, this will all be over. at least until 2020. Over the past few days, President Trump has been crisscrossing the country, stumping for Republican candidates in the lead-up to the midterm elections. And one of his biggest talking points, fear of immigration.
What's happening right now as a large group of people, they call it a caravan.
He's referring there to the caravan of Central American migrants that's been growing since they first set off almost 2 weeks ago from Honduras. The migrants have now reached southern Mexico, where many are requesting asylum. Others will continue the arduous, weeks-long journey by foot to the United States. The president has made no secret of his feelings about certain groups of immigrants.
You wouldn't believe how bad these people are. These aren't people. These are animals.
They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists. They are not our friend, believe me.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States.
So we want to take some time today to do some fact-checking on this caravan of migrants coming from Central America.
Do you have any evidence that there are terrorists in part of this caravan?
You know what you should do, John? Go into the middle of the caravan, take your cameras and search. You're going to find MS-13, you're going to find Middle Eastern, you're going to find everything. And guess what? We're not allowing them in our country. We want safety.
Here to help us unpack all of this is Ron Nixon, the New York Times' correspondent covering the Department of Homeland Security. Ron, thanks for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So lots of stuff to take into consideration here. We just heard the president's comments about there being Middle Easterners in the caravan. He later said he had no proof of that. But clearly this was a dog whistle, I'm thinking. Who was in the caravan, Ron? What do we know?
These are people that are primarily migrating and seeking to get asylum, primarily coming from Honduras. And I understand that there are some people from my colleagues on the ground. I understand that there are some people from Guatemala and maybe a couple of other places in the Northern Triangle countries. But it looks largely like it's a crowd of people, well, group of people coming from Honduras.
Now, we also heard Mike Pence, Vice President Mike Pence, and Sarah Huckabee Sanders, who were saying that there were about 10 terrorists or suspected terrorists coming to the United States every day. That was something that they said around this caravan. Let's take a listen to Vice President Pence.
Well, it's inconceivable that there are not people of Middle Eastern descent in a crowd of more than 7,000 people advancing toward our border.
Inconceivable.
I mean, the truth is, well, let me sure. Statistics on this. I mean, in the last fiscal year, we apprehended more than 10 terrorists or suspected terrorists per day at our southern border from countries that are referred to in the lexicon as other than Mexico. That means from the Middle East region.
Ron, does other than Mexico mean from the Middle East? What is he referring to there?
So other than Mexico includes everybody who's not from Mexico.
Okay, so it's not a direct...
Including people from the Northern Triangle. And that's primarily who's been referred to as other than Mexico. But it really does include anyone who is not from Mexico. And that's because traditionally, up until a few years ago, most of the people seeking to come across the border, either get asylum or crossing the border illegally, were people from Mexico.
He's also made some claims about MS-13, and I don't want to minimize the concern about MS-13, but I do want to check with you to see, is there any evidence of MS-13 so far being a part of this group or having any influence over this group?
I haven't seen anything that suggests that MS-13 is a part of the group. The president's comments about take your camera and go in the middle of the caravan and you'll see MS-13. I don't know what MS-13 would look like. I mean, there are certainly members that have the facial tattoos and things like that, but not everybody who's MS-13 looks like that. So, you know, as far as I know, and from my colleagues on the ground there and my coverage of this, we have not seen any evidence of that to date.
There's another concern, and I think this is really a question of language and dog whistles when it comes to race and in politics. And I'm wondering, are the Republicans nervous here, Ron? Do you think that's why they're doubling down on this rhetoric just 2 weeks before the midterm elections?
I think immigration, obviously it helped the president get elected. And this has been one of, if not the signature issue for this administration. And I think that for a lot of Republicans, it plays well, particularly now. You see cameras with this crowd of people coming to the country, and you can point to see there they are. There are these people who are trying to get into our country. So I think for them, it's an issue that they feel they can gain some traction with as, political scientists and pollsters are predicting a blue wave, particularly in terms of taking the House of Representatives.
Yeah, we've also heard Mike Pence say that it is the caravan is a Venezuelan plot. The president has suggested that the caravan is being supported by Democrats. George Soros' name has been tossed about. Ron, do you know, can we confirm any of those claims?
There is no evidence that the Democrats or George Soros or Venezuela have sponsored this particular caravan. And remember, this is something that happened earlier this year, too. There was a caravan of people coming to the U.S., and most of them actually didn't make the trip to the U.S. It sort of petered out before it actually got to the U.S. border. So ultimately, we don't know what's going to happen with this group of people because they're about 1,000 miles away.
Right, which is more than Miami to New York from what I understand.
Right. Yeah. Right, and they're walking. Right.
Right. Right. So take that into consideration. Thank you. Ron Nixon is a correspondent for the New York Times covering the Department of Homeland Security. Ron, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Today's podcast is sponsored by Babbel. People around the world are learning new languages with the Babbel Language Learning app. Learn Spanish, French, Italian, German, Russian, Swedish, and more with Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons. You'll learn through interactive dialogues, speech recognition, and fun trainers and quizzes. And in a few short weeks, you can be speaking a new language with confidence. And Babbel is available as an app or online. And right now, you can try Babbel for free. Go to Babbel.com and download the app and try it for free. That's right, Babbel, Babbel.com, or download the app to try it for free. Babbel.com.
A sea urchin dubbed the cockroach of the ocean has almost completely destroyed the kelp forests off of the coast of Northern California. Kendra Pierre-Lewis is a climate reporter for The New York Times, and she's reported extensively on this story. Kendra, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks so much for having me, Tanzina.
So what exactly are these poor little urchins doing off the coast of Northern California?
Basically, it got really hot, and their key predator, which is a kind of starfish, died off. And the hot weather sort of made it harder for the kelp to produce. And that twin effect of sort of the loss of their key food supply or the reduction of their key food supply and the loss of their key predator triggers something in the purple urchins. I call it going hangry, They just sort of come out of their little crevices and they line up in what they call these fronts, and they just start mowing down any remaining kelp or algae or anything else that's out there.
And what's prompting them to get hangry? Because, I mean, I get hangry. Don't we all kind of get hangry? But, like, what's prompting the sea urchins?
Basically, it's climate change, unfortunately. It's climate change.
And what is a kelp forest? I mean, we hear about kelp, but is this really a critical part of the ecosystem on this coast?
Yeah, it's huge. And it's not just on the California coast. There are kelp forests pretty much everywhere in the world except for Antarctica. You find them even in Greenland. And so they're just like forests, except they're underwater. They're food for a ton of animals. For other animals like rockfish, they nurse and they hide out in the kelp forest from their other key predators. So they're a huge part of the food web or the interconnection of how food operates in the ocean. And then from a climate perspective, they're plants, so they absorb carbon emissions. And so not only are we losing this key ecosystem in the sense of like where we get fish and food and all of these really important things from, we're also losing one of the key ways that we can help fight off climate change.
Is there anything, any way to feed the sea urchins so they don't attack the kelp?
So what they're doing in Northern California, basically, is they're going into the ocean and they're pulling out the purple urchins. There are a couple of plans to try and see if they can fatten them on land. For a variety of reasons, the way that purple urchins work in Northern California, they're not really commercially viable.
But they're meaning we don't like to eat them?
It's not that we don't like to eat them. It's that the purple urchins in particular get to the size where, like, they're gonads, which is what we eat. It gets to full size sort of this time of year in the fall and in the winter. And it's not safe to go out and fish it. And that's under normal conditions. But because they're starving, basically, they're really hungry. If you were to crack one open right now, there's no food inside.
No wonder why they're hangry.
Pretty much, yeah. It's kind of like they get really hungry. They realize that their food is running out and that there's nothing to eat them. And they sort of go into this panic. And that creates this frenzy that in turn actually makes them go hungry. And they also, the way they eat the kelp is the worst. They eat the bottom of the kelp. And so 90% of the plant just floats away. So they don't even get all of the food.
Oh, these little urchins. I think we need to talk to them. Kendra, how is this going to affect, I mean, all jokes aside, how would this affect Californians and so the environment there? Yeah.
Yeah. The environment, well, it's already affecting Californians. So as I talk about in the article, they used to have about 100 red urchin, which is a different color, much larger urchin, commercial divers. They're now down to about 8 or 10. For the first time ever, Northern California had to close its recreational abalone fishery, which contributed something like $44 million a year to the local economy. And there's a really good chance they're going to have to do it for another 2 years because abalone also eat kelp. And without kelp, they're also starving. And so they're expecting to see ripple effects in the next few years in the rockfish fishery as well. And so it's just going to continue going down the line.
Kendra Pierre-Lewis is a climate reporter for The New York Times. Kendra, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
We now go to Massachusetts and the Commonwealth's ballot question number 3. In 2016, with strong bipartisan support, the Massachusetts legislature passed an anti-discrimination law that protects the rights of transgender people in public places, and opponents immediately moved to repeal it. Now it's being put to the voters to decide. Gabriella Emanuel is a reporter for WGBH in Boston, and she's here to give us an update on question 3. Hi, Gabriella.
Hi there.
So Governor Charlie Baker first signed into law in 2016, and we should mention that he's a Republican. Why is this even on the ballot today?
Well, the day he signed it in, this repeal effort kind of was underway already. So a group known as the Massachusetts Family Institute, they strive to promote Judeo-Christian values here. They have been pushing to repeal this. And their big concern, they say, is safety of women and children. And what their argument is that the law that you mentioned, the 2016 law, is too broad in the way it defines gender identity. It doesn't require someone to be on hormone treatment or have gender reassignment surgery. It just needs to be a sincerely held part of their identity. And they say this is too broad and people can take advantage of it. And they're concerned that people will pretend to be transgender, go into women's bathrooms and prey on women and children. They're particularly concerned, they say, about convicted sex offenders. And the one other thing is worth noting is that there isn't actually data to back up those arguments, but that is the concern.
Well, that's the concern. Let's talk a little bit about what the law was meant to do. How is the law meant to protect transgender folks in Massachusetts?
Yeah, so what it did is it inserted two words, gender identity, into the list of characteristics you can't discriminate someone based on. So already there's race, sex, creed, religion. Now, among others, gender identity. And this is in all public accommodations. So anywhere the public goes, think hotels, restaurants, hospitals, taxis, but also public bathrooms and locker rooms.
So essentially, this is the bathroom debate that's now extended itself to Massachusetts in many ways.
In many ways, although it comes from a non-discrimination law, so it's a positive protection versus not letting them go into the bathroom.
I'm wondering what the opponents of this law are doing. Is there advertising around this? Are they doing outreach? How are they trying to, you know, really influence voters?
Their main strategy, as I've talked to them, has been advertisements online, on the radio, and the prediction is on TV soon.
And what's the response been from transgender activists and civil rights organizations?
Yeah, they say that what's at stake here is kind of the basic respect and dignity of fellow Massachusetts. And they have been very active canvassing across the state. I've spoken to somebody who actually kind of left their business to canvass full time and work on this campaign. And that was a transgender woman. And she actually said that if this repeal does happen, she'll look to move to another state. She's looking to New Hampshire, where there are protections.
And what do the polls say about question three? Is there enough support to keep these protections in place as we head into the election?
Yeah, so the most recent poll from the Boston Globe, UMass Lowell, found 74% favored keeping this law. That is up from polls over the summer that found it closer to 50% were in support of it. The concern from the campaign trying to keep it is that there will be a last-minute kind of blitz of lots of TV ads preying on people's fears.
So is there still bipartisan support, or has this become politicized given the current climate?
So it's up to the voters, and it looks like there's support on both sides. As you said, a Republican governor signed this into law. One interesting thing this poll found is that the voters may not fully understand the law. When you ask, do you want to keep the law, they say yes. But when they say, are you okay with transgender individuals going into the bathroom, they're less likely to say yes.
We'll be paying attention. Gabriella Emanuel is a reporter for WGBH. Thanks, Gabriella.
Thank you.
On Sunday, November 4th, the whole country, except for Arizona and Hawaii, will fall back 1 hour to get back the 60-minute daylight saving time stole from us back in March. And 2 days later, Californians will have a chance to decide if they want to join Arizona and Hawaii and live in permanent daylight saving time, meaning no more clock changing. That's right. In California, daylight saving is on the ballot, Proposition 7. And lots of you say, right on.
Hi, this is John from Buffalo. I have been railing against the time change for years. I have a sleep disorder. It really throws my body clock off for weeks every time we do it.
This is Peter from New York. I absolutely would support an end to the changing of the clocks, anything to avoid disrupting my young children's already fragile sleep routine.
Hey, this is Dan from Portland, Oregon. Yeah, I'm down for the time change thing. It seems silly to change our clocks twice a year when we adapt to much larger changes in light and day than an hour can possibly account for.
Danielle Venton is an editor and reporter for KQED Science in San Francisco, and she's been reporting on the measure as well as the origins of the practice and the case against it today. Danielle, thanks for being with us on The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
So where did this ballot measure come from? Who wanted to eliminate daylight saving time in California?
This is from a state assembly member. This is sponsored by a state assembly member in San Jose, and he heard about the issue from his constituents. It was his dentist, actually, who showed him medical studies that link that loss of an hour of sleep in the spring to increased stroke, traffic accidents, and heart attack.
Wow. So there's actual consequences to clock changes.
There's pretty good data that loss of sleep throws off people's circadian rhythms, disorients them, and puts them at higher risk of all of those things.
So it's not just that we're grumpier. There's actual real change. Interesting. What's the case for Prop 7? Like, what is the case in addition to any of the health concerns, are there other reasons why Prop 7 wants to be, why folks are pushing Prop 7?
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty unpopular practice to switch clocks. So there's some popular support for keeping the clocks steady year-round. Also, when we are using daylight saving time, we have that more light in the evening. And there is some economic benefit because, and some public health benefit because people are out exercising, they're out eating at restaurants, they're playing sports, they're walking their dog.
Now, why do we have daylight saving time in the first place? Can you remind us?
Yeah, the idea dates back centuries. It was Benjamin Franklin who wrote the first proposal. He was probably joking, but at the time, this was in the late 1700s, he was living in France. He was the American ambassador to Paris, and it was his habit to sleep, to work late into the evening, writing by candlelight until 3 or 4 in the morning, and then he would sleep until about noon. And one morning he got woken up by this loud sound at 6 a.m. and realized, oh, the sun's up. I could be using the sunlight to write by. I don't need to spend all of this money on candles. But it wasn't until World War I that it was really adopted by countries. It was Germany that was the first country to institute it. And then all of the countries that were involved in the war effort adopted daylight saving time to save energy. And it did used to save some energy. It doesn't save much now, it seems. It was then made optional between the wars. It was brought back again in the United States for World War II. And in California, voters voted to institute the daylight saving time schedule that we have now in 1949.
Now, some of our listeners may remember the last time the United States didn't switch to standard time, which was back in 1974 during the oil crisis. Can you tell us what happened then?
Yeah, President Nixon ordered year-round daylight saving time for 2 years to save energy during the OPEC oil embargo. But it was incredibly unpopular because it meant very cold, very dark mornings, especially in the northern latitudes. And it was so unpopular that Congress ended the experiment a year early.
Now, I'm wondering about, you mentioned northern latitudes. Now, is daylight saving time something that really helps those of us in the north and maybe hurts those of us in the south or who are closer to the equator?
Well, I wouldn't say that it hurts people who are closer to the equator, but the shift of light versus dark is, of course, much more drastic in the northern latitudes. You know, on the equator, we have 12 hours of darkness and 12 hours of light. So here, for instance, in California, if this proposition passed and California did indeed go to year-round saving time, the sun wouldn't rise in the shortest days of the year in LA until about 8, but in the northern parts of the state, it wouldn't rise until about 8:45.
Wow, that's pretty intense. You know, we did ask our listeners for what they thought about this idea, and there were lots of folks who supported it, as we mentioned earlier. You know, there's a lot of support in California for this right now, but I do want to play you a comment from one California voter.
Hello, I'm Alexis from Los Angeles. As a Californian, it is a pointless measure that would use resources that could be used for other issues, like healthcare, homelessness, education, pathway for immigration, prison reform. The list is endless. Even if the measure passes, it still needs to be approved by Congress, and who knows how long that would take. I vote no.
Danielle, we've just got a coming up on the end of the segment here, but is that an accurate representation? Would it take resources away from needed services to make this change?
You know, the fiscal impact is really unclear. It would require some extra money to coordinate airline flights and, you know, with other states, but it also could save money with decreased accidents and increased productivity.
Danielle Venton is an editor and reporter for KQED Science. Danielle, thanks so much.
Thank you.
All this week, we've been exploring our election system, the nuts and bolts and the holes and gaps that make it vulnerable. Today, let's talk about solutions. What would it really take to make things better? Danielle Rood is the voting rights manager at the Center for American Progress. Hi, Danielle.
Hi.
So we've been talking about this issue all week. We're going to continue talking about it tomorrow. But we want to talk about not just pie-in-the-sky solutions, but actual practical solutions. What are some of the things that people can do to fix the system? Like, where do we begin today?
That is an excellent question. And the good thing is that most of the solutions to better our election infrastructure are practical. So, for example, I would say that the first thing that states should do, if this is applicable to them, is if they are still using any kind of electronic paperless voting machines, so typically we call those DRE machines, they need to replace them with paper-based voting systems. You know, election security experts, computer scientists have all warned about the vulnerabilities of these paperless machines. And the reason is that there's no reliable paper record of the voter's intent and how he or she chose to vote. And so we need those paperless electronic machines to be done away with and to be replaced with a paper-based system that can be relied upon then later on by election officials in post-election audits.
It's interesting we're talking about paper because it's one of the things we assume is sort of outdated, right? We do everything on our phones and everything else, but it's an interesting point that you make. What about auditing elections? We had a guest on yesterday that said, you know, we can do that to a certain extent, but we don't have a system in place to audit all votes. Is that right?
Right. So, you know, you think of after an election, after Election Day, there are millions and millions of votes cast. So it's really not feasible to audit every single vote. And it just, you don't need to either. You just need to be able to audit the precise number of votes necessary to confirm the outcome of an election. And the scope of an audit, the size will depend on the margin of victory in a given contest. So if the margin of victory is quite large, election officials should only have to audit a smaller number of ballots, whereas if the margin of victory is small, election officials should be able to alter the scope of the audit to make sure that they're auditing more ballots to confirm the outcome of that tight election. But auditing really is necessary to protect our elections and ensure the integrity of our elections. And, you know, paper-based voting systems are incredibly important, but the overall impact of a paper-based system depends largely on election officials and states' ability and commitment to carrying out robust post-election audits that then look at those paper ballots, a small sample size, for example, to ensure that voters' intent and voters' choice are accurately represented in the outcome.
What about training when it comes to folks that work at the polls? How important is that?
Training for election officials and at the state and local level election officials is of utmost importance, particularly under the current threat environment when we know that the vast majority of attacks and attempts at manipulating our elections are cyber-based. Our election officials at all levels work incredibly hard to protect our elections. And for the most part, they do a really, really excellent job. But most election officials are not trained cyber experts. And, you know, we can't really expect them to be. There's, you know, the cyber expert community is growing by the day in this country, but we need a lot of election officials. So we really need to begin training and intensively training election officials on how to recognize cyber attacks and the proper way to respond to any fishy or suspicious activity that they see either on Election Day or when they are managing or overseeing the state's voter registration systems. So, you know, showing a video or, you know, having a conference for election officials once a year or twice a year is fine. It's a good starting point, but more certainly needs to be done. Colorado, for example, just a few weeks ago carried out what they called election war games, where it was really role-playing various election emergency scenarios, including cyber attacks, that included election officials from all over the state so that they were prepared and had actually practiced responding to some of these attacks. And that's the kind of intensive training that I hope becomes implemented nationwide for future elections.
And what about the federal government? I mean, I'm still surprised that we don't have a sort of federal voting system, but where can the federal government come in and help some of the states?
So DHS, who has sort of been managing the federal government's response to the Russian attacks in 2016 and ongoing attacks that we know are occurring leading up to these 2018 midterms, DHS has a variety of services that it offers states to bolster their election infrastructure, including performing vulnerability assessments, which are free to states, by the way. There was, of course, earlier this year, I believe, a waiting list for states to receive that kind of assistance, which was unfortunate. But as far as I know, DHS has now sort of caught up and is performing those assessments at a speedier rate, which is great. But in addition to supplying sort of advanced cybersecurity measures and tests for state election infrastructure, the federal government plays a significant role in information sharing with state and local officials. Federal officials, particularly national security experts, are privy to some of the more classified or higher level threats to our elections that state officials and local election officials are not privy to and are not receiving talking points on, but also readouts of who our adversaries are and what they're trying to do to infiltrate our elections. So there needs to be a direct line of communication between the federal government, what they're hearing, what they know, and the state and local officials who are working to protect our elections on a daily basis. And there have been efforts since 2016 to better that communication line. For example, DHS and EAC, the Election Assistance Administration, have held conferences with state and local officials to sort of talk about these issues, how they're going to better the information sharing system. But there's always room for improvement. There are still states and local officials who say that they, you know, are unaware of what's really happening in their locations, in their jurisdictions. So information sharing still needs some improvement between the federal government and state and locals. But I do think there has been improvements since 2016. So that's always good.
Danielle Root is with the Center for American Progress. Danielle, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And that's our show for today, everyone. You can always call us with anything, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.